From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is continuing to escalate his rhetoric against North Korea. This morning, he tweeted, "Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely. Hopefully, Kim Jong-un will find another path." That followed a statement from North Korea saying that Trump was, quote, driving the situation on the Korean Peninsula to the brink of a nuclear war. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been tracking all of this and joins us now. Hi, Greg.
Hi there, Jeremy.
So President Trump used the phrase locked and loaded. Do we have any more sense of what he meant by that?
Not really. In Hollywood Westerns, it means somebody's about to get shot. In the modern military, it's not a technical term. It doesn't have any specific meaning, but it certainly escalates the kind of rhetoric we've been seeing. He talked about fire and fury earlier this week. What it is a real break with the tradition. When we've had these episodes of high tension in the past, we usually see U.S. presidents sending a firm but very measured response, and here we're getting increasingly escalatory responses from the president.
And what about the military presence that the U.S. has right now in and around Korea? If this were to turn into some sort of military action, what is the U.S. presence there?
Well, there's a large permanent presence. There's 29,000 U.S. troops in South Korea that are stationed there permanently. They've been there since the Korean War of the 1950s. Large U.S. presence in Japan as well, an air base in Guam in the Western Pacific. So there's all sorts of resources the U.S. has. But what I think is significant is we're not seeing a buildup or any real addition to that that you would expect if there was an anticipation that there was going to be a large war. Also, a lot of American citizens in South Korea, they would be getting some sort of evacuation notice or some sort of something like that, and we're not seeing that either. So we're seeing this large presence that's in place and could act or react, but we're not seeing additions to that presence.
U.S. officials are saying they plan to go ahead with large-scale joint military exercises with South Korea that are planned for 10 days from now. These have been scheduled for a long time, but how might they affect the current situation?
It's going to make it more tense, no doubt about it. The North hates these exercises. The U.S. and South Korea do them every year, about twice a year. Big one in the spring in March and April, then another one around this time of year. It is designed, it's announced very publicly and intended to show the U.S. and South Korea are there to prevent any attacks, any major ground war from the North. It's not set up really as a way to exchange missile fire or anything like that. Some additional troops do come in for these exercises, and you see a lot of heightened rhetoric whenever they take place from the North. So it's coming at a very bad time, but these were long scheduled training operations, and they're going to go ahead as scheduled.
Greg, a number of U.S. lawmakers and former diplomats have criticized President Trump for his language on this issue. Here's General James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, speaking on CNN.
For decades, we've heard this kind of rhetoric coming out of North Korea, and typically we ignore it. And certainly at the presidential level, we ignore it. So the rhetoric itself is not helpful.
People have been pointing out that it may hurt efforts to eventually have a dialogue with North Korea. What are people saying about Trump's rhetoric?
Well, again, as we heard from Clapper, I think that's been – we've heard that pretty widely, that, again, this is so untraditional coming from the president, and it's having the – it's escalating tensions, no doubt about it. Now, it may be an effort to deter North Korea. Certainly, we would see these firm statements in the past, but it is this real break with the tradition, and therefore, we don't know how this dance is going to play out, because we do see these very heated statements come up time and again, and then things calm down. But since we're seeing this rhetoric keep ratcheting up, we're waiting for a sign that it might come down.
Well, what about diplomatic efforts going on to resolve the crisis?
Well, it's difficult for the U.S. and North Korea to talk to one another. They don't have the traditional embassies or other channels. Now, North Korea does have an office at the United Nations in New York, and they can send messages that way. We've seen a report today from the Associated Press that some back-channel negotiations have been going on, and according to this report, it involves Joseph Yoon, who is, in effect, the U.S. envoy to North Korea. He went to North Korea to bring back Otto Warmbier, the American who was released there and then died upon his return to the U.S. So there are ways to send messages, to have contact, but it's not the normal diplomatic channels by any stretch.
That's Greg Myrie, who is NPR national security correspondent, talking with us about the current tensions between the U.S. and North Korea. Greg, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Jeffrey Lord, conservative commentator and stalwart supporter of President Donald Trump, has been fired from CNN. CNN fired him after he tweeted a Nazi salute while arguing online with a liberal media analyst. Now, Lord says he was mocking Nazis, not endorsing them. And Candy Woodall, a reporter from PennLive.com, writes today that she was at Lord's house last night talking with him when White House chief strategist Steve Bannon called to tell him to, quote, keep fighting, according to the reporter. Well, joining us to take a look at this and other news in social media is Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us from Washington. Hi there, Femi.
Hello there.
So this story about Jeffrey Lord started out online with his tweet. Explain what happened and what the reaction online has been.
Well, this is a classic case of Twitter side. You tweet and then you're fired. Bit of a backstory, as there is with all Twitter sides, and that is the ongoing back and forth between Media Matters for America, the self-described progressive media watchdog, and Jeffrey Lord, who until quite recently was one of the highest profile Trump supporters on CNN in terms of being a political analyst. So there's a little bit of back and forth between Media Matters America and Jeffrey Lord about a headline that he tweeted out. So Media Matters says that the headline isn't very accurate. Jeffrey Lord tweets back two words, Zig Heil.
Mm.
a matter of moments later, he was out of a job.
Moments later. I mean, I think Twitter does this to people, that they get in these back and forths and they only see the mentions, but they forget that literally everybody else can see those tweets.
Absolutely. And Jeffrey Lord, as he was online, he was debating with tweeters who were saying, this is disgusting. This is totally inappropriate. Hashtag fire Jeffrey Lord. And he was trying to say, look, I am standing up for free speech. I am talking about people squashing my free speech and describing their behavior as being Nazi-like, as being fascist. And there was a lot of sarcasm involved, but sarcasm doesn't always come over well on Twitter. CNN said very bluntly, Jeffrey Lord is no longer with the network.
Yeah, whether or not one believes he was being sarcasm. So I would say sarcasm never goes over well on Twitter. But let's move on to some of the other social media news of the week. There's a photo that's gone viral. It was of a back-to-school display at Walmart, and the retailers had to apologize for this display. What happened?
Well, let me just paint the picture for you on the radio. So you have a gun cabinet in Walmart, and then just above the gun cabinet, it says, own the school year like a hero. Of course, Twitter went apoplectic. Mm. That picture was shared virally. Walmart even tweeted out, that was truly awful. And then a sad emoji face. Nice one, Walmart. We immediately removed the sign from the display as soon as we found out the store location. But they're having trouble finding the store location. And it could very well have been a staff prank where the staff dared each other. I dare you to put that school sign above the gun cabinet. Didn't work out quite so well. And Walmart is still apologizing for that.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so there's also another story about a new filter that was put out and then quickly withdrawn from Face app. Now, for, you know, me and my impending decrepitude, am I too old to know what Face app actually is?
Well, you probably don't take too many selfies. If you love taking selfies, you may well have heard of Face app. It is a selfie editing app, which means that you can put filters onto your selfies to make yourself look different. Now, using tech, you can make your sad face look happy. You can make your young face look old, your old face look young. It's pretty magical. It's amazing. So FaceApp, and the app is designed and made by Russian designers, brought out a new set of filters just a few weeks ago. And their filters were, you could make yourself look black or Asian. Shall I continue? Or Caucasian or Indian. truly amazing. Digital blackface, who knew? People went nuts. It was seen as basically a racist app. And FaceApp have had problems with this in the past. They did an app a little while ago. And this app was to make you, the filter was to make you look hot. But the only thing it did was to make you look paler. Oh. Now, the trouble is they'd only use as their data white people. So if your idea of hotter is by using white people in your data, of course, you're only going to get lighter. It doesn't take into account all the other ethnicities. So I think FaceApp now are going to just stick to general things like a smile upside down, turning it up, putting wrinkles, taking wrinkles away, because the ethnicity filters are not going down too well. People are very, very upset about them.
Mm. Well, that's Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, bringing us up to speed about yet another controversial week in social media.
Every week. Well, don't like to disappoint.
It's a good thing. We'll always have something to talk about.
Always. See you next week.
Thanks a lot, Femi.
Take care.
Next week marks the 70th anniversary of the partition of India and Pakistan. At midnight on August 14th, 1947, the British ended their rule over the Indian subcontinent and divided it into Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan. Now, that break led to a massive spasm of violence. Millions of people were forced to flee their homes, and as many as 1 million people died as families and communities were torn apart. So what is the legacy of partition, particularly in Pakistan? Moeed Yusuf is Associate Vice President of the Asia Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and he joins us from Lahore, Pakistan, via Skype. Moeed, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, Moeed, I guess for people who don't really study South Asia very closely, it's easy to think of this upcoming anniversary as the anniversary of Indian independence, but it's also the anniversary of Pakistan. So how is it being marked in Pakistan this year?
Pakistanis, quite frankly, just like Indians, it's a special day for them. It's a very patriotic, very nationalistic, but yet a very rowdy country, if you will, and a rowdy polity when it comes to marking their independence. So you've got the state level sort of demonstrations of force, of grandeur. There's a bit of British pomp still left over, I would say, from the British time. So it is very much a special day. There isn't much that the society does as a collective on the day. But the state does put out a lot of pomp right from the beginning of the day, right through. And you'll see that streets are clogged, people are out, people are having fun. It's more a joyous celebratory occasion than anything else.
Interesting. Perhaps, these 70 years later, it makes sense. But of course, we should remember that partition and the birth of these two nations was also an event that was, awash in blood, right? 12 to 15 million people having to flee their homes. An estimated 1 million people died and killed along the way. Horrible violence done to women, again, on both sides. So just remind us. I mean, and in fact, if I understand correctly, your family had to move significantly during this time. Is that right?
That's correct. So my grandfather actually and all of his family and some of my uncles did move from what is Agra in UP in India today, which is India's largest state. So yes, absolutely. It's very personal for us and myself as well. Look, you're absolutely right. Partition has a very dark side to it. The difference here, Megan, is that in India, partition, I think, still very much reminds them of an occasion on which the country was split. In Pakistan, you've almost blocked that part of it out. And the conversation really is about a new country, a new promise, a cherished homeland that was expected, that was fought for. So there's a very positive connotation attached to that event and independence. And sort of the dark and the unfortunate side of it does not really come up in the conversation as much as it does in India. Also remember that 70 years down, the generation that actually went through partition, who saw the horrors of partition, has now you know, a lot of them have passed away, and sort of you've just got the last sort of remnants left. So it doesn't really make it into the national narrative in Pakistan as it perhaps does in India.
Well, that's very interesting. Nevertheless, you know, history should be observed, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But Pakistan itself also went through a considerable period of tumult after the creation of the nation, because Pakistan at that time wasn't even contiguous, right? There was West Pakistan, of course, we know that as Pakistan today, and East Pakistan, which is, of course, now Bangladesh. And there was tumult there in the formation and independence of Bangladesh.
I think that's absolutely correct. Look, when you get to the real meat of the debate on independence, and something that Pakistanis do remember every time on the 14th of August, and if you would turn on television channels, you'd hear this, is a bit of a lament about unfulfilled potential. It's a conversation about forefathers having given up their homeland, traveled hundreds of miles to come to this new country, starting off with a major refugee crisis, with no resources, and then building Pakistan into what, you know, in the 60s, Samuel Huntington called the Asian Tiger. And so there's a bit of lament on how Pakistan has not continued on that trajectory, how the problems that Pakistan faces leave Pakistan as a impoverished developing country where it could have had much more. We also have this conversation, as you mentioned, about the 1971 debacle, as it's known, where Bangladesh split from Pakistan, today's Pakistan, and became an independent country. But again, that's a conversation that's largely blocked out of the national narrative, unfortunately. So it's a mixed bag, but when you really sit down to the real conversation, Pakistanis do deep down feel that they haven't done nearly as much as this country promised.
So tell me a bit more about that, because of course, South Asia, and particularly Pakistan, from the point of view of the United States, still remains incredibly important for strategic reasons. And so how much of the position that Pakistan finds itself today, I mean, you were talking about the lament about development, how much of that can be traced back to the manner in which the nation was born?
I think in some ways it can. Pakistan had a very, very difficult start. As I mentioned, the refugee crisis, if you look at the resource base that this country had, it was non-existent. Remember, British India, and even before that, sort of the Muslim rulers of the Indian subcontinent, always saw today's Pakistan as a buffer zone. It was the least developed, one of the least developed parts of British India and pre-British India, very few industrial units, very little development. And so they didn't have a very hard start. But that's where the unfulfilled potential comes in, because within 20 years, they turned the country around into, you know, something of an Asian tiger. I mean, Pakistan was growing much faster than India. It was sort of spearheading the region in some ways. So yes, you can trace it back to that. But then you've also got to accept that Pakistan did show real potential to become, a middle income developed country. And then things started falling apart with, various governance problems, deep-seated corruption, interrupted democracy with the military stepping in from time to time, and on and on. And so today you find Pakistan, yes, strategically crucial, a nuclear power, has a lot of feathers in its cap, and yet it creates this tension in the world. It sort of worries the world more than it interests the world, given all the sort of terrorism problems, all the law and order problems, and all the divergences of interest with the U.S. when it comes to Afghanistan.
Hmm. Well, speaking of the political challenges that Pakistan faces, I mean, it was just last month, right, that Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif stepped down following an order from the Pakistani Supreme Court over corruption, as you were talking about. Is that overshadowing at all the celebrations of the 70th anniversary?
It very much is. The whole conversation in the past couple of weeks in Pakistan, and I've been following this from close quarters, has been about what is called the Panama Gate scandal, where, you know, these Panama leaks that took down the Iceland prime minister. It saw David Cameron in the UK having to apologize because his father's name had shown up, apparently, and the Pakistani prime minister and his family's name, because they had some offshore companies that weren't declared assets. And so he did lose his job. As we speak, He is trying to get his supporters to rally behind him, denouncing the Supreme Court verdict that ousted him, and declaring that there's been a conspiracy to take him down. So very much a political crisis in Pakistan. Unfortunately, I think it's going to linger for the coming months. But right now, the talk of the town, at least in the city that I'm in, is the prime minister, the former prime minister, arriving back with his supporters. Rather than independence, which literally is a couple of days away.
Well, finally, Muid, the partition that created both the modern Indian state and Pakistan, as we've been talking about, in many ways is a wound that's never really healed. I mean, the two nations have been at war in the intervening 70 years a couple of times. I mean, how would you describe what the current state of relations are between India and Pakistan?
No, you're absolutely right. And this is one of the most unfortunate parts of this history. Four wars and a number of bouts of serious tension, constant acrimony. And these two countries really take the blame for holding the entire South Asian region back. It's the single least integrated region in the world because of this tension between India and Pakistan. Relations remain as bad as they've been. India sort of explicitly taken a policy of trying to isolate Pakistan globally, Pakistan standing up to the challenge, their sort of concerns about terrorism, their concerns about a tit-for-tat proxy war, quite frankly, even in Afghanistan. So things are as bad as they get in some ways. They're always on the verge of a crisis with nuclear weapons involved. And so they keep the world worried. I unfortunately see no easy way or no quick fix for this relationship. I think it's destined to remain tense, at least for the foreseeable future. Mm.
Well, Muid Yusuf is an associate vice president of the Asia Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He spoke with us from Lahore, Pakistan, about the 70th anniversary of the partition of India and Pakistan and the creation of the Pakistani nation. Muid, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Things are looking up for SoundCloud today. Investors in the music streaming service voted to inject $170 million into the company after SoundCloud had struggled financially over the last year and earlier this summer had to lay off about 40% of its staff. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York with more. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do we know about this new investment into the company? Because just last night, people were saying SoundCloud could be out of business in a day.
Yeah, that's right. It really was a make-or-break round of funding for SoundCloud. It just wasn't clear that they could survive without it. And what happened is investors from two firms, Rain Group and Temasek Holdings in Singapore, have agreed to pump about $170 million into the company. And the new funding round really greatly reduces the valuation of SoundCloud. It lowers its worth to about $150 million before considering this new cash. And that's down from a previous valuation of $700 million. So they're taking quite a hit. And the deal also comes with quite a few strings attached.
Including the fact that the CEO, Alex Young, is going to have to step down, right?
That's right. Investors are bringing in Kerry Trainor as CEO. And he's a veteran of the internet. He was a former executive at Yahoo and AOL. And he was the former head of Vimeo, which is an online video service similar to YouTube. And the reason they're doing this is they also plan to shift SoundCloud's business strategy to some degree. They wanted to focus on selling tools for the musicians and DJs and podcasters who actually use the site. And that's a similar business model that Trainor built at Vimeo. So they're hoping he can sort of recreate that notion at SoundCloud.
Now, SoundCloud is known for launching up-and-coming musicians. When Chance the Rapper won the Grammy for Best Rap Album this year, he thanked SoundCloud for getting him started. When we speak to DJs, they're always telling us that they find some of the best new music on SoundCloud. How does it compare to the other streaming services like Spotify or Pandora?
Well, as far as users, it's very big, 175 million users. It's been described as the biggest of the streaming services. And what you're talking about is really how it differentiates itself. It had sort of set itself apart by being, you know, with content that was often user-generated from DJs and independent musicians and podcasters. But further down the line, they tried to take on the Spotify's and Pandora's of the world by striking deals with record labels to stream popular music. And a lot of people in the tech press sort of thought that was a bad idea. And this strategy sort of takes them back to their roots as a site for do-it-yourselfers rather than a company that's trying to play the music of the big record labels.
But they've still got challenges ahead even after today?
Absolutely. I mean, look, this is a very competitive business. You have companies like Apple and Amazon and Google with music services that are really meant just to draw their people's attentions to their other products. So SoundCloud will have to really capitalize on this new business model and find a niche out there that some of these big tech companies aren't going to muscle in on.
That's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The great Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt takes the track for the final time tomorrow night in London. He'll be part of the Jamaican relay team at the World Track and Field Championships. So far, Bolt's final appearance on the world stage has not gone according to plan. In last Saturday's 100-meter final, Usain Bolt lost. He was beaten by his longtime rival, American Justin Gatlin. And that's booing there because the crowd was not happy. They jeered as Gatlin received his gold medal. He's seen as something of a villain because Gatlin has been suspended twice for using performance-enhancing drugs. BBC sports correspondent Alex Capstick joins us from London. And Alex, were you surprised by the level of scorn heaped against Gatlin when he beat Bolt?
I think everybody was a little bit surprised. It wasn't that he booed after he'd beaten Usain Bolt, because he'd been booed throughout the tournament, you know, the first round, the semi-finals, and then before he competed in the finals. So it wasn't a surprise that he was booed when he won, but it was a surprise when we first heard it, because Justin Gatlin has raced in Britain before. He raced at the London Olympics, and there was no hint of a boo then. But I think here, you know, the final appearance of Usain Bolt, his last individual race, the final time we'll see him in competition in the 100 metres. Everybody was hoping for the golden send-off for, you know, arguably the greatest athlete of all time, and certainly a man that has carried the sport almost single-handedly since he burst onto the stage in 2008, winning that gold medal in the 100 metres, breaking a world record, and then doing it again in the 200 metres at the Beijing Olympics. So everybody was hoping for this fantastic send-off for Usain Bolt, and it was spoilt by Justin Gatlin. You might remember a couple of years ago at the World Championships in Beijing, when Gatlin was running very quickly that year, and he was expected in many ways to beat Usain Bolt, and it was cast as good against evil because of Justin Gatlin's doping. Usain Bolt snuck past him. At this time, Justin Gatlin wasn't really given much of a chance, so when he won, it was a real surprise that he did win. And then, of course, the boos came down, which we'd heard before. I mean, I felt a little bit uncomfortable about it because it was, Justin Gatlin has done his time. He is there in the stadium competing. But on the other hand, you can understand it, because people were so wanted to see Usain Bolt win, and they were sort of taking it out, I guess, on Justin Gatlin.
Yeah, I mean, so the circumstances around that race are very specific, but I mean, we've heard so much about doping in track and field, one would think that Russian athletes ought to be booed every now and then as well, too.
Yeah, well, that was the point made by Justin Gatlin's agent, Ronaldo Namaya, when he spoke to us afterwards, and he said, well, no one else was booed. There were lots of other former drug cheats racing in London, and there are, and nobody paid any attention to them. It was just on Justin Gatlin. I know that the World Anti-Doping Agency, who watched this from afar, they were quite pleased at the booing. They want to see crowds and the public acknowledge that doping is a big problem, and they say, even though that it's probably a little bit unfair on Justin Gatlin, as I said, he was there, he served his time, but you're right, there are plenty of other people, Russians included, who others may feel shouldn't be competing in London but are.
How much of a problem is doping still in the sport?
Well, it's still a huge problem, and the doping authorities will tell you they don't have enough money, nowhere near enough money to tackle the problem. On the other hand, you know, there have been strides. They've got this biological passport now, which is helping the testers target individuals. They have this retrospective testing where they can go back 10 years and then retest samples and find people that have been doping. That's been a big feature over the past year or so. They've been finding people who were doping in Beijing and were doping at the London 2012 Olympics. So they've got much better equipped now to deal with it. They don't pretend to be on top of it all, But I guess it's a case of maybe a glass half full rather than half empty.
Now, Usain Bolt is going to be part of the Jamaican relay team tomorrow. You know, following his loss to Gatlin, it must feel as if there's a lot riding on him to go out with a victory.
It'll be really interesting to see how he handles the occasion, and also with the reaction of the crowd around him. They will be chanting his name, you can be sure of that, and they will be desperate to see him go away with a gold medal. If the Jamaicans don't get it, it'll probably be like a pin pricking a balloon if they don't win tomorrow.
Well, that's the BBC sports correspondent Alex Capstick speaking to us from London. Alex, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Moving over to Washington, D.C., it's famous for the statues and monuments that fill the city's parks, traffic circles, and public spaces. Many of the statues honor U.S. presidents and generals and international heroes, but there aren't that many that celebrate local legends, particularly minorities and women. As WAMU's Michaela Lefrak reports, some Washington residents say it's time to diversify.
It's hard to walk more than a couple of blocks in Washington, D.C. without seeing a statue. Take Capitol Hill, where there are monuments to 19th century statesmen, including Edwin Stanton, William Henry Seward, and President Abraham Lincoln. On a recent afternoon in Lincoln Park, people walk their dogs and take their kids to play on the jungle gyms. But just a few people pay attention to the statues.
People don't really study the history. They pretty much ignore these statues. I mean, they're familiar with that one.
This is 9-year-old Isabella Ruth. She lives in Capitol Hill, and she's pointing to the statue of Lincoln. But it's the park's other statue that really gets her excited. It's a bronze statue of an older black woman with a cane standing next to two little kids. Isabella knows exactly who the woman is.
Mary McLeod Bethune. She wanted to fight for rights for everyone, and even through everything, she was always telling jokes.
Besides being a joke teller, Mary McLeod Bethune was an educator and civil rights activist who lived here in the early 1900s. The memorial to her in Lincoln Park was erected in the 1970s, and it's maybe the only statue in D.C. to honor a black woman. Jane Levy is the chief historian with the Historical Society of Washington, D.C.
There's an issue here in Washington that there are so many statues, and they are mostly old white guys.
Levy says because so many different entities have jurisdiction over D.C. land, it's hard to keep track of exactly how many statues are in the city. Some are National Park Service projects, others were gifts of foreign governments, and a few were funded by private groups. But one thing is clear. On local land, there are only a handful of statues that honor women or people of color. And, Levy says, very few of them even spent time in the district.
We have, you know, statues here to Ukrainian poets and to French saints. So where are our local heroes? Who are they and where are they?
The few that do exist are mostly of what Levy calls twofers, people who lived part of their lives in D.C., but were more famous on a national scale. Mary McLeod Bethune is one example. D.C. native Duke Ellington is another. He has a statue outside the historic Howard Theater.
It's terrific to have him there. And he's a classic twofer. Got his musical training here, did his early performing on U Street, and yet he really became known when he left town.
The lack of diversity and local representation among the city's memorials is an old problem. Most of the city's statues were built in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And D.C. Councilman Kenyon McDuffie says the city needs an update. So he's put forward a proposal for a bill that would fund 8 new statues, one for each of the city's wards. They'd all be of Native Washingtonians who are women or people of color.
With all that we're seeing nationally, with some inflammatory political rhetoric, I think now's the time to really memorialize statues so that our young people can see themselves among the heroes that we honor.
McDuffie's bill is still in the early stages, and he doesn't yet know how much it would cost the city. But he does know who the first statue should honor, the renowned black lawyer Charles Hamilton Houston.
He graduated from D.C. public schools and was responsible for laying the groundwork that led to the historic Supreme Court case Brown v. the Board of Education.
After that, the city would decide on 7 other honorees. McDuffie already has some ideas.
There are people like Charles Drew. There are people like Euphemia Lofton Haynes. There are people like Shirley Horn.
Back at Lincoln Park, Isabella Ruth and her 10-year-old brother Gabriel have some candidates, too.
Who would you want it to be?
Susan B. Anthony. Or Harriet Tubman.
Who would you pick?
It would be Rosa Parks. She didn't let anyone step over her. She didn't let anyone, like, push her down. And I think that took a lot of courage.
Neither of the kids has much to say about Native Washingtonians. But that could change if the city erects 8 new statues of Washington women and men. The proposal to make that happen goes before the D.C. Council in the fall. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac in Washington.
What would get you to stop driving alone to work? A better train or bus system? Bike lanes? A coworker who lives nearby and can carpool with you? Well, in Seattle, the answer appears to be in the way businesses charge employees to park at the office. David Gutman has been writing about this. He's transportation reporter for the Seattle Times. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you looked at a couple of organizations in particular, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which opened a new headquarters in Seattle in 2011. What did they do to reduce driving alone?
Well, when they moved into this, or when they were building this new headquarters, the city told them, you know, you have to reduce the number of employees who are driving alone. This new location just can't handle all the traffic. And so they did several things. But one of the most, you know, easiest and most impactful things they did was they started charging for parking every day. So instead of charging a monthly rate, say $200 a month, they just divided the monthly rate by the number of workdays in the month and said, we're charging you the same amount, but you've got to make that decision to pay every day.
Hmm. And what kind of a difference did that make?
Along with the other changes they made, it made a huge difference. You know, before they moved into the new headquarters, they had nearly 90% of their employees driving to work alone every day. A year after they moved into their headquarters, it was about 40% of their employees driving alone to work. So it the rate plunged.
And do we know why? Have people explained to you why that makes such a difference if the price is the same in the end?
I mean, they're not the only company that's done it, and I don't know if they have like a perfect explanation, but it just makes sense if you think about it. If you're paying $200 a month for parking, it's something that's set into your monthly budget. You don't even think about it. If you're paying $15 a day, you've got to think about that every day. I'm driving to work. I have to pay $15 just to leave my car, and it's just kind of another pain point every day. And the other thing is, if you're paying a monthly charge, the first day you drive that month, you're paying $200, and every day after that is free.
Right. So you want to get the most out of it after you've already made the investment.
Exactly. Once you drive that first day of the month, why would you consider taking the bus or carpooling or walking or biking any other day? You want to maximize your investment you've already paid.
Well, let's talk about that, because Seattle is a place where there are other options. People can get to work by bus or by biking. Not everywhere has that advantage.
Absolutely. That's the whole kind of background for this parking policy discussion, is that if people don't have other options, you know, it doesn't matter how much you nudge them or incentivize them toward not driving. If there's no other option, they're still going to drive. So in the city of Seattle, where lots of companies kind of do programs and incentives like this, only about a third of commuters drive alone to work every day. There's also pretty good bus service and light rail service in the city of Seattle and to the city of Seattle. When you look at surrounding cities, suburb cities, which oftentimes don't have as good or as reliable transit service, the rates of single car commuters are much higher.
There are laws behind some of what's going on in Seattle. Tell us about that. There are actual regulations that say that companies have to do certain things to try to reduce the amount of people who are driving alone to work.
Yeah, it's actually a state law, and it's been on the books since the early 1990s. Originally, it was to kind of an effort about, you know, to fight air pollution. And it basically says every kind of metro area in the state that might have traffic issues, which obviously includes Seattle, the city has to have a program where they work with large employers to get those employers to reduce the number of solo car commuters. And so here in Seattle, there's a nonprofit that's funded by some tax money, but also the kind of Downtown Business Association, which will go and, you know, send people to large employers to say, okay, here's a what's your commuting program? Here's what other companies have done. Here's what we've found works. And these are some strategies you can use to kind of get people commuting in alternative ways.
How do you get to work?
Today, I'm riding my bike to work. I take the bus probably about half the time. It kind of depends on weather and my level of laziness.
But you never drive?
I never drive. It's too expensive to park.
That's David Gutman, who is transportation reporter for the Seattle Times. We'll link you to more about what they've been doing there in Seattle at hereandnow.org. David, thanks.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is back on Monday. This is Here and Now.